Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and this week I am looking for a wonderful book about the Harlem Renaissance, which I just learned existed about a week and a half ago.
Nick, we are here to educate you, yeah. Mostly. Oh, you know, the lit heads probably knew it existed, but we're here for you, Nick.
That's right.
We're here for you.
I will be navigating.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
So clearly I will be navigating us through this. To help me with those recommendations are my friends.
That's like an increasingly tenuous term every week, isn't it?
Really fumbles me every time.
A word being gradually sapped of all of its meaning.
The lit heads can't see the air quotes. Two gentlemen and high school English teachers, which makes them slightly more qualified than my friendship, to help us with this. Ian and Joe.
My name is Joe Holshue. I have a story about the word friends, but I don't think I'll tell it right now. My name is Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, I don't think you could talk about the Harlem Renaissance without talking about Langston Hughes. So I think a first for me, instead of bringing a book, I brought a handful of poems that I'd like to talk about. And mostly, I'd like to talk about the man himself, Langston Hughes.
Would you call him the man, the myth, the legend?
The man, the myth, the legend. That term was first applied to Langston Hughes. Nick, that's your first fact about the Harlem Renaissance.
That can't be true.
Listen, well, I know what you're going to do. You're going to try and start horning in on my Hobbit territory and say, I've got Hughes facts for you. Well, let me tell you right now, Joe, no, it's mine. It's mine, my precious, my own, my territory.
All right, I will call him something else.
My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I am an English teacher of the high school variety. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book from the Harlem Renaissance, I would recommend Nella Larsen's second and final novel, Passing. And Joe, today,
yes.
I would like to especially welcome you to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I don't think anybody's ever welcomed me to this podcast before.
You are welcome to the podcast.
I have not.
Yeah, I would like to point out that not only have I never been explicitly welcomed, I feel like I've been explicitly like not that welcome.
Ostracized. Yes. Anybody want to welcome me? Fuck you guys.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Nick, or Ian, I have a question. So her second and final book, it is called Passing. Did she die? Like, did she die? Did she pass away?
What does that mean?
I mean, we'll get into this.
I don't even understand the question.
Passing, like somebody passes away.
Are you saying the book that she wrote is about her dying?
I don't know. It's her second book. It's her final book. It's
like
called
most autobiographies. It ends with her recounting her own death.
And this is how I die. What a great first question. Let's jump right into it. Ian, please go ahead and answer. Is this about her own death?
It is not. It was published about 35 years before she died.
Interesting.
If you want more details about this strange thing, I'll have to tell them to you in my time because it's a really interesting whole situation.
Okay.
Ian, I have a question. Hold on,
questions McGee over there. Hey, guys, so what is the Harlem Renaissance? Who wants to take this one? Both of you at the same time?
We could both take it at the same time.
We could speak in unison.
Sure. But let's try that for the first time ever.
Yes.
Nope. I'm tapping out. I'm tapping out on my own bit. I don't like that, and it scares me.
Yeah. Oh, Nick, I actually do have a... when we talk about the Harlem Renaissance, I think very frequently, the way I introduce it in my class and the way I think a lot of people are introduced to it is through a Langston Hughes poem. Nick, can I read you a very short poem? It's called Harlem.
Sure. I mean, all right. This is highly irregular, but I guess so.
Are you trying to suborn the victory there, Joe?
I think he's only going to read poems this episode.
I've got a lot of poems lined up, guys. I'm not going to lie.
It's like
going
to be Art of the War all over again.
Art of War Redux. Yeah, exactly.
Nick, this poem is called Harlem. It's about 12 lines long. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust over like syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
Great. So I have a question for you guys. What is the Harlem Renaissance?
That doesn't fill in the Harlem Renaissance for you. I don't know what will.
Nick, I feel like the question has been answered. Nick, can we please move on to the next
Ian,
question?
Ian, can you try?
Sure. I'll give you my best shot. So I have things to say about how the Harlem Renaissance specifically connects to my book, but just broadly here, I'll say that this is an era of flourishing of black art, primarily localized around
Brooklyn.
The area of Harlem in New York. But it wasn't just restricted there. It's a descriptor used for kind of this just burgeoning of artistic endeavor. So not just like literature, poetry, novels, plays, acting, but also architecture, design, painting, any kind of fine art. And it was interesting because it was for the first time, one of the first times that black art was kind of accorded white critical acclaim. Mm. So in the past, black art had been just like black people were doing art for hundreds of years before this. But for the first time, white people
art had
deigned to say, oh, yes, I think that's actually quite good.
Was that your white guy impression?
That is Ian's impression of a white guy, Litheads.
It is spot on.
Thank you.
And so is this where the Harlem Shake comes from? Is this the origin? That is correct?
Possibly the distant origin.
Distant origin. Okay. Fantastic. What's the time period here?
The dates I saw... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I just Googled origin of Harlem Shake, and Google tells me that the Harlem Shake originated with a drunken man named Albert Boyce dancing at Harlem's Rucker Park basketball court in 1981. So
81?
Yeah.
That thing took 40 years to get relevant?
To get to the internet?
This is often how it goes.
We have a long path ahead of us for this podcast, potentially. This could be a good 40 years before Audible picks us up.
Well, just got to stay the course.
Anyway.
When we talk the dates for the Harlem Renaissance, Nick, we kind of talk like early 20th century, so like 1910-ish through like 1930, like something in that realm. Turns out that the Great Depression was pretty tough on black art, among other things.
I didn't know it was that early.
Mm, when did Nick? When did you think it was? Like, if you had to guess, when the Harlem Renaissance?
60s, 70s. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know why. Again, just learned this existed, so I'm along for the ride, and I'm very happy to be here.
No, so, well, last week, Ian talked about the Great Migration. Yeah, Ian talked about the Great Migration out of the South, and when one of the places that a lot of African-Americans settled was Harlem in New York.
One of the central characters from, or the central figures in The Warmth of Other Suns, the Great Migration book, George, the citrus picker from Florida, he actually goes to live in Harlem, and he kind of experiences Harlem after the Harlem Renaissance, but it's still this center of sort of black culture, black cultural identity. And there's a lot of cultural history there.
Well, welcome everybody to You Don't Know Lit, a weekly literature podcast where we pick a theme, which is meaningless. Yeah,
I'm sorry. Do we have to say it's weekly? Can we say strongly? I don't like the weakness.
Yeah,
Nick is silent because he's laughing so
Welcome
hard.
Welcome to our strongly podcast, where we pick a theme every week. I'm sorry. Every strong. And two idiots bring book recommendations for not only me, but for you, Litheads. But we do have
You're
some rules
great
here.
Hands, Litheads.
Jesus Christ. This week we might be adding a show rule, something along the lines of no talking. But for now, we'll just stick with these three. The first being only unavoidable spoilers, gentlemen. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing that's important here.
I'm really excited to bring poems this week because I feel like the first two rules aren't going to apply that much. Like, you can't really spoil a poem, and I can't say that much about them.
That's right, Joe. Good job.
I'm playing poetry from here on out.
Now, normally we take 30 seconds to just give me a little taste about your book. Joe, here's your 30 seconds has started. I don't know what you're going to talk about. So
yeah. So today, Nick, I want to talk to you about Langston Hughes. He is, of course, the darker brother. They send him to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but he laughs and he eats well and he grows strong. Tomorrow, Nick, he'll be at the table when company comes and nobody will dare to say eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they will see how beautiful he is and be ashamed. Nick, today I want to talk about Langston Hughes. He did a bunch of things, but mostly he's a poet.
All right. I'm not sure what you just said.
Snuck a poem in there.
I did get it. Yeah, it sounds like he just snuck a quote in there. Sorry about that, Ian. That will go against his points.
Good. Good. I expect justice.
Yeah. I also didn't get a page count. So
But page count for poetry? That this particular poem is 14 lines long.
I don't make the rules, Joe. Ian, you have 30 seconds.
Oh, my novel is the story of a relationship between two women. Friendship shades into rivalry, danger lurks, secrets are kept, and tragedy ensues. Passing by Nella Larson was published in 1929 and runs to a slender 215 pages, and the drama of the book's history is as gripping as the book's own story.
So this week it's almost like a group of writings versus one writing.
Yeah.
How are we doing this?
Very carefully.
Very carefully. Okay. Asked and answered. I didn't like the way that Joe answered some of my questions so far this today. So Ian, why don't you go first?
All right.
I'll take it. Okay.
I have a question. Oh, let me answer it with a poem. Like, what? Like,
I can guarantee that I will be doing none of that over the course of...
What's the Harlem Renaissance? Let me recite you a 14-line poem.
I'm just going to look up... Cool. During Ian's time today, I'll be looking up more poems to share with the letters.
Great.
We're all
Joe, I hope all of
that.
Your questions for me during this, during the next 20 minutes are just poem in the form of poems. Okay, so I thought I would talk first about just kind of what happens in this book a little bit longer. I said some things, just general stuff, like it's a relationship and
you
so
did.
Forth. But
you did.
The story is, it's actually a really good story. This is a book that just had a huge kind of cultural and intellectual, like almost philosophical impact, which I'll talk about in a bit. But it's a good story. I don't want to gloss over that fact. It's a really compelling, kind of simple, focused story. So here's the story. Our main character is named Irene, and she has a friend named Claire, and we just kind of follow their relationship from early life. They grow apart, they get reintroduced. Claire sort of ends up integrated into Irene's life, and then there is a pretty major tragedy that sort of develops from their relationship. In this book, the title doesn't refer to Nella Larson passing away. It refers to the practice of racial passing, where someone, a person of color who is light-skinned, or who can appear through the use of clothing or makeup to be white, to not be a person of color, passes the color line and is treated in sort of pre-civil rights society as white, as privileged. So we've got a couple of Irene and Claire are both black. Irene has a black husband. Claire has a white husband who hates black people, and Claire's husband doesn't know that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Keep going.
He doesn't know.
I'll just write down my questions.
He doesn't know that she's black. So Claire is passing in her marriage.
That's really passing. That's like, yeah. like yes. For passing, you get an A plus if your husband does not know your block.
No.
No. So, okay.
So, and this is
I'm just
going to
interrupt you. So how does he not know?
Well,
he doesn't know his wife is black.
Yeah. One of her parents is white.
Is this an arranged marriage?
Black? No, no. She is conventionally beautiful according to white standards. And this white guy says, "Wow, you're beautiful," and doesn't know that she has a black parent.
Sorry.
Well, and this reminds me of Trevor Noah a little bit in South Africa. I talked very briefly about being able to like graduate from being black to being white, and the state would have tests that they would do on you, right? So like you would go and you would apply and you'd be like, hey, I think my blackness is diluted enough that I am no longer black. And one of the tests that they would do is they would put a pencil in your hair and see if it stayed there. And if it fell out, you could be white. So that's what she has. Like she's white enough.
Jesus.
Right.
Well, no, we didn't talk about that. That is a shocking story.
But this is what Joe brings up is a part which I guess I was going to get to later, but we'll get into it now. Have you heard of the one drop rule? Does this ring any bells?
One drop rule.
Do you want us to make like jokes or should we just
I don't
say
think
no?
You should make jokes because this is like a bit of structural racism, which is pretty dreadful.
Thank you for the warning. Yes.
And that's why I asked.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't want to patronize if you already knew about this, but here's the deal. This was a rule which was sort of set in stone in some. It was an actual law in some areas. It was more of a recommendation in other areas. But the idea generally was you would be considered to be black if you had one drop of black blood in your veins. So if you had one parent or one grandparent or one great grandparent or so on, if you had any bit of non-white heritage, you would be considered black.
Okay.
And so even though Claire, who is our married to the guy who doesn't know she's passing, even though Claire passes really well, she passes really easily. She doesn't have to really like do invasive cosmetic stuff like straightening your hair a lot or wearing a lot of makeup. She passes fairly naturally, but she is still considered by him and by society to be black because she has one little bit of black heritage. And this is interesting because it cuts both ways in this book.
I thought you said he doesn't know.
He doesn't know.
At the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Okay.
I am spoiling a little bit, but this is a thing that happens. Like, honestly, when we have this kind of narrative set up, you know he's going to find out eventually.
Right. It's like it's the inherent tension in the plot.
Right. Yeah. Like, is this dreadful racist guy?
And then
he finds out
and that particular and story structure never resolves.
And things are fine.
It's happy and everyone's fine. The interesting thing about this is that it kind of cuts both ways. So one of the reasons Claire is this really interesting character because she's really beautiful and she's really witty and clever and a great conversationalist, a really good host. She's kind of like everything a society person should be. But our main character, Irene, doesn't like love her. Irene is not sold on Claire. And one of the reasons is
she jealous?
Yes, kind of, I think.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. She doesn't come out and say, I was jealous of her.
I am jealous.
That's part of it. The other part, though, is Irene believes that Claire should be more in touch with her black culture. She feels like by passing, Claire is kind of leaving her blackness behind and disassociating herself from her people, her cultural, you know, folks who were part of her culture when she was young. So there's one drop principle. The white people kind of apply it to black people, but also she's applying it. Irene's applying it and saying, well, Claire, you are one part black. So that means you ought to be more tapped into our Harlem society. So a lot of it takes place in Chicago and the rest of it takes place in Harlem. It's what you might call a big city book.
So, right, yeah, as most people define big city books.
Big
most
city.
People always keep an eye out for big city books like we do.
Love some big city books.
And would you Oh man, we pick great themes here.
we're not strong at themes.
Part of the fun we have is coming up with themes no one's ever thought of before.
Pretty strong yeah. at books, not so strong at themes.
Better at book. Sorry, the connection here between this book and the Harlem Renaissance is this was just written during the Harlem Renaissance. Is there any connection to like that time period in New York?
Yeah.
Well, I also think like that idea of being in touch with black culture, like what it means to be black, yes. what it means, like that's like foundational to the Harlem Renaissance. Maybe I should have right. said that instead of reading my poem. I guess that's my bad, guys.
Yeah. We could just maybe for the rest of the episode make a list of things that you could have said instead of reading a poem. But let me ask a better question, Ian. What is the connection between with this book and the Harlem Renaissance?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that question. So
you're welcome for that question.
I'll go ahead and give you at this point, I think, a question point. You can have a question point for that.
Oh, Nick, congratulations on your question point.
Thank you.
Yeah, mark that down. So Nella Larsen was a member of the Harlem Renaissance. She lived in Harlem. She was a member of this kind of group of thinkers and artists and critics.
And shakers.
In movers and shakers, yeah, intellectuals and general shakers. Kind of the cultural milieu at this time. So she was like writing letters to Langston Hughes and other people, and they were in touch with her. She would hold these parties, and people, various luminaries from the Harlem Renaissance, would come. Mm-hmm. So she was involved with this. It's also written about characters who are experiencing the Harlem Renaissance. There's a kind of a pivotal part of the novel where there's a benefit dance that's given, and it's to benefit a particular group, which is designed to bolster black art. So these people these characters are involved in the Harlem Renaissance. Larsen was involved in the Harlem Renaissance, but she was kind of on the outskirts. So this might be a good time to talk a little bit about her, because she's a really interesting case.
Ian, I think rather than that, I think this might be a good time to talk about her a little bit.
Yeah, that might be. You know what? You're right. I accept the rebuke, and I will instead talk about her.
Thanks. Let's just pivot a little bit. All right.
Let's just pivot. she was born to a black father and a white mother. Her father disappeared early in her life, and her mother remarried a white guy. So now you've got a white mother and a white stepfather and a black daughter. Okay. So she gets discriminated against in white society because of the one drop rule. Because her family situation, people will notice like, oh, huh, that's interesting. She doesn't look like quite like her parents.
I'm beginning to see some sort of potential path here, some connection to the narrative. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, keep going.
So she gets discriminated against in white society. She also gets discriminated against in black society.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say it.
Has a white parent. Right.
Yeah.
So she is kind of like everyone in this novel. Her first novel was...
people suck.
Yes, that was kind of
yeah. Poor girl.
Her first novel was autobiographical, and this one also has some elements. Not so much like what happened to her in her life making its way into the novel, but sort of the experiences with discrimination, I think. So the thing is, she married this really prominent black physicist and moved to Harlem. So like, for a woman who is discriminated against by white people, you think, okay, maybe she'll like have it better off. They say she's too black. Maybe if she goes and participates in black culture, she'll be better off. But no, she's not black enough in Harlem society. She has a white parent. So her husband kind of gets her some entree to these circles, but she's kind of on the outskirts of social life because
of everyone.
Sure. Yes, which is a bummer. And so she wrote this novel. She won a Guggenheim Fellowship after she wrote it.
What
went to Europe.
That? Besides fun to say.
That sounds very elite.
It's like, okay, you guys know about MacArthur Genius Grants?
Nope.
Yeah, we know about those because, of course, Colson Whitehead, one of our previous authors, was the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant.
Basically, this is a foundation, Nick. You should look into it because I think you're really, you'd be great for this.
Oh.
It's a foundation which basically says, hey, you're a genius. Have a bunch of money to just do your thing.
Yep. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Think I could qualify?
Yeah. Podcasts, I think we could do it. All the three of us could get one of these for this podcast, most certainly. So the Guggenheim is not quite as much money, but it was quite a bit of money. And they just said, you're a good author, have this money and go do more art. So she went to Europe and started working on a different novel and it didn't get published. She also published this short story called Sanctuary, and critics said this is plagiarized.
Oh no.
And not clear if it was. There are certainly similarities to a different short story. The one that they say was plagiarized from, but it's not really clear what happened. But this, I think, took the wind out of her sails. She divorced her husband because he was having affairs. She was kind of therefore excluded from Harlem society because he was the way she got in. And so within 5 years after this novel was published, Nella Larson was not writing anymore. She stopped writing. She was a nurse for the last 20 years of her life. And then she died in her apartment in Brooklyn at 72.
Wow.
So she writes this novel. She writes this novel, right? This hugely sensitive, it's really short, but it's really powerful, a good story, culturally important, introduces or kind of brings to the front this idea of racial passing, gets the fellowship, and then everything falls apart and she is, she stops writing.
Huh, that's a bummer.
It is a downer.
So do you know how when you read a piece of student writing that is clearly not their own work, you know instantly. Have you had this experience?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like students, they always think they're getting away with something. And it's just so unbelievably obvious when students are plagiarizing. So Ian, my question to you is, you've read this book. Mm-hmm. Did she plagiarize? I mean,
in your professional opinion.
That's right. You are a plagiarism detection machine. Did she plagiarize?
Don't go easy on her.
this book is not the plagiarized one.
This book is not the one that people thought. But it's a legitimate question. I think anytime somebody is accused, having looked at the two stories, the story that she published, which people said was plagiarized, it's possible. It's certainly possible. I don't think this novel was plagiarized because it feels very personal. It feels very, very personal. And it feels like the kind of thing, like the emotions that she describes and the sort of currents and eddies of Irene's reaction to Claire, like they're good friends and then they're bitter enemies and then they're kind of both at once. I'm not going to say the word frenemies because I hate that word, but
can I?
They're kind of like Nick, friends and enemies at the same time.
Frenemies.
It sounds like you're really skirting the question here, Joe. The novel does not feel plagiarized. I could see it with the short story, but the novel feels very...
It feels honest. It feels
authentic. Not this novel that is accused of it.
No.
It's another one.
Correct.
You haven't read that other one, though.
Nick, whenever plagiarism happens, we have to look at everything. If once a plagiarist... We have to pick up other on everything and say, well, have they been lifting from other people their whole life? And this novel is clearly... clearly Larson's. It's clearly not just because of the stuff that I kind of shared about her experience with discrimination, but also how it taps into the Harlem Renaissance stuff. So
is there anything on her? Did she ever comment on this?
No.
You know, basically dropping the mic and being like, fuck you guys.
No.
I mean, does she comment on well, I'm just going to be a nurse. I'm done with this.
No, she did not ever kind of have her final moment in the sun. She, in fact, the final years of her life, subsequent biographers had to kind of piece it together from various, basically detective work in records, in hospital records and things she was here. And this person is Nella Larson. Okay. Connecting the dots. She was just done. She was, I think she went through a lot. She was clearly very talented, and it was kind of a society which didn't have a place for her. And so she went through all this stuff from the highs of, you know, passing. It got a lot of critical acclaim, got the fellowship. And then people are like, oh, actually, you're plagiarizing from this white lady author.
Oh, jeez.
And she was just like, I'm done. She was a good nurse. She was a nurse for like 20 years. And she cut off all of her contacts with her friends. And just she was just done.
Why should I read this book, Ian? Last question. Answer wisely.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to the plot for a second, because this is something which I think is valuable. So we've got our two main married couples, Irene and her black husband, and they're okay. They're fine. They're not perfect. No married couple is, but they're, relatively speaking, they're fine. Then Claire and has this white husband who is a piece of work, hates black people, doesn't know she's passing. There's another kind of foil couple. This is a character, a more minor character named Gertrude. Gertrude has a white husband who does know that Gertrude passes. So they kind of have these different representatives or avatars of different ways that black people can be in the world. And this story focuses on Irene and how she reacts to Claire, but it also deals with all these other kind of eddies and currents in how people in a marginalized culture can deal with the dominant culture. I'm going to talk about the Harlem Renaissance quick to kind of answer this question, because a big part of the Harlem Renaissance is the way that white people kind of worked with, interfaced with this black culture, artistically formidable black culture in Harlem. Like, everyone knew that what was going on in Harlem was awesome. And white people kind of interacted in different ways with it. Sometimes it was voyeurism, like you would go and watch it, like it's an amusement park. You go and watch the black people doing their art. If you're a white person in the 20s in New York, some of it's appropriative. So if you're a musician or you're an artist, you might go and kind of watch what black art is doing, and then go to the mainstream and profit off of it. Some of it is, this is the most interesting to me, some of it's patronizing. So rich and influential white people kind of took it upon themselves to uplift black artists. So they would say, hey, I have a lot of money. How about I give you some of that and you'll do this art? And it wasn't always like really above board. There was there's one, I think her name was Charlotte Mason, who insisted on being called Godmother Mason. And she would say, all the art that you produce when I pay you is mine. It's kind of exploitative is the point.
Okay.
But then there's also like
mean.
Yes. Mean is a great word for it. there's also the element of just legitimate acceptance of black culture as cool and doing good art. So this book, I think, sketches a whole bunch of different ways that white culture and black culture interact, and it really shows kind of the destructive effect that the negative approaches can have. So, like I say, there's a huge tragedy. The whole book kind of builds up to this, and it blows up, and it's a, I'm sorry to say, it's a bit of a downer. But
obviously, it's, you don't know Lit. We only bring downers.
we only bring downers. But the way it wraps up is really powerful, and it's really like, earned. It's really well earned to get to the end. It feels like these things could only have ended in this way. It's not like you can guess where it's going, but you have a pretty good idea of the direction. That's all I have to say about it.
Cool.
Powerful ending there. Mm-hmm.
And that's all I have to say about that.
On March 2nd, it's Dr. Seuss's birthday, so I have a question for you. Was he a real doctor, or was he a doctor like Ian is a doctor? Was he like working on patients? Do you guys know? You guys are teachers, you should know this.
I think I would need to research that, but I kind of think he maybe was.
Like a surgeon?
Yeah, maybe he was like cutting people up, but like rhyming as he did so. Like, I do believe have a broken bone, and that's the reason that I'm reaching for this phone.
Oh, very good.
Because he's going to call the nurse and say he has a broken bone.
Right, because of the bone. Yeah. So Maybe while you prepare, you could also read a Dr. Seuss book and then bring it to me.
That sounds sure.
While you do your research,
I'm in. Okay, I'll do the research, and then in honor of his passing, I will read The Lorax, which is a good book by Dr. Seuss. Maybe not a doctor.
Quote unquote Dr. Seuss.
Okay, so Litheads, this week I will, of course, be bringing, in honor of my godson Harrison, Hop on Pop. And yeah, I might change it.
All right.
So my tentative commitment is Hop on Pop.
Hey, Joseph.
Yes.
I want to hear about your poems.
Okay.
Now, Nick, when you say you want to hear about his poems, are you lying?
Well, I wanted to hear about a book during the that, you know, is relevant to the Harlem Renaissance. So
sure.
I didn't really necessarily ask for this book, but I'm just going to take his word for it.
Well, Nick, I've got great news. I've got a book right here in front of me right now. I'm just... Do you hear me flipping through those pages?
Not here, an idiot.
Yeah. the sound that you hear is the collected poems of Langston Hughes, Nick. It is a book. So
fair enough.
Yep. So stop being a jerk.
Okay. I'll stop being a jerk, but I do have one more jerky thing to say, and then I'll stop. Okay.
I'm ready. Yep.
Question.
Does this jerky thing count against my time? Like, should I have started my timer?
Your time already started.
Oh, okay.
And it's not your timer. It's my timer.
Well, technically,
it's the Litheads timer.
It's the Litheads timer.
It is the Litheads timer, but they can't, you know, the logistics of them controlling this timer.
You are in loco parentis for the Litheads.
Oh, that's Nick, how I'd say congratulations on loco parentis.
Joe.
Yes.
I don't like poetry.
Oh, yeah. Get in line, man.
So let me get it out. Let me get it out of my system here. I just think that poetry should be something enjoyed in the privacy of your home without telling anybody anyone ever that you enjoyed it. And that's the best way to enjoy poetry is alone. Maybe there's a candle
in secret.
In secret, and you can't tell anybody.
So Nick, I'm about to drop on you one of my most controversial opinions as an English teacher. And it's something I wasn't going to say. I was not planning on saying this coming in, but you have
the Litheads and I are bracing ourselves.
That you've twisted my arm. Nick, I also don't love poetry.
You son of a gun. Poetry is amazing. Am I the only person on this podcast to defend poetry?
Can we mute
it
Ian?
Sounds
Nick,
like
is there
it.
A way for Ian to get off the rest of this call and for you and I to talk about
No,
to just
we
slam?
Have equal share in this podcast.
Okay, so this is my actual take on it. I think poetry is a blast to teach. Right, like I think poems are short. You can put them in front of students. We can read them together. We can talk about what's interesting in them. I think the form itself really, really lends itself toward like enjoying, dissecting. I don't know the verb here inside of a classroom.
I don't know how you teach. Yeah. So you're saying I'm going to enjoy hearing about this poetry more than I am actually reading it.
Okay, so that brings me to my second point. Normally, when I'm sitting down and prepping Normally, when I'm sitting down and prepping for the podcast, I get really worried about, boy, I'm not going to have enough time to say all of this. I'm not that worried about that today. Like, I don't have pesky things like plot to talk about or,
annoying. Yeah.
Yeah. Like those annoying things. Like, I have to tell them about the
page
plot,
counts.
But I can't. Yes, page counts. I have none of that today. Nick, I have a couple poems from Langston Hughes that I want to talk about that I think are kind of cool and that I think like are worth reading and they're super short.
Before we go on, Ian, do you need to defend poetry to like, to breathe again?
Right.
No,
do you need to like slap me with a glove and
I thought Joe was gonna come in hot with like poetry is actively bad. We shouldn't read it.
Oh no.
Against poetry.
No, I don't think that, but I don't know. Sometimes I wonder what happened to poetry. Like when you Ian, I don't have to tell you, you have a PhD in Shakespeare, but like poetry
Yes. Don't start talking about Western heritage and what happened to our civilization, because that's where we kind of go off into territory we don't want to go into.
Oh, so is that like when I ask what happened to poetry, is that the question that I'm beginning to ask? Because I didn't know that.
No, you're fine. You're good.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know what happened. Like, it seems like poetry used to be like a thing, like a medium that people enjoyed and read to one another. But I don't know. Now I think it's kind of, for good or ill, reserved to classrooms.
Yeah. I mean, classrooms and other poets.
I think real poetry's on YouTube.
Classrooms and poets.
Well, but okay. Nick, what did you say about YouTube?
I think real poetry these days are on YouTube.
Okay.
Isn't poetry just an expression? Like, I don't know.
I think you're being snarky, but I think there's some legitimate value.
Yeah, I'm not articulating it correctly, but I know what I'm saying.
Okay. Good. Good.
Do you want me to try harder?
No, you're fine. Let me float an interpretation. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
So maybe like conventional poetry where you write a poem down and then it gets published. Maybe that's kind of dying on the vine, but other forms of poetic expression, specifically kind of visual stuff. And honestly, like you listen to, I'm going to sound like an old guy right now. You listen to some of the hip hop these days.
The hip hop.
Yeah. People are really good at making poetry over beats. Like, I kind of think this is the new heyday of poetry. Recently, and by recently, I mean several months ago, a very influential British rapper died. His name was MF Doom. You may have heard about this. He died in October, but they only released that news.
They just published it. Yeah.
Yeah. Much, much later. But he was a guy, I've listened to some of his work, and he was a guy whose command of the English language was so complete, and he would do such complex things. Like, poetry is a great way to describe what he was doing. Maybe he would have called it that, maybe he wouldn't have, but that this might be a place where poetry is kind of getting new life.
Yeah, Ian, I'm so happy that you said it, because like it was the thing that I was trying to avoid saying, but I always think that like hip-hop music is the English teacher's medium. Like English teachers should listen to rap music. And that makes me sound like such a dorky old white guy when I say that. Tell that to a class full of teenagers and they turn on you instantly.
Yep.
But I totally agree, right? Like when I think of like the rappers that I really, really love, when I think of Kanye West, when I think of Kendrick Lamar, right? Like I think of like people who are above all else, really like, well, A, rhythmic geniuses in the case of Kanye West, but like poetic geniuses. That's how you describe Kendrick Lamar.
Kendrick Lamar won a Pulitzer.
Kendrick Lamar won a Pulitzer.
For the album Damn. I discovered this in doing research for last week's thing. So, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Or 2 weeks ago.
That was a great discussion on if poetry still exists. But, Joe, tell me about tell me everything. I'm looking at a photo. Let me start you off here with a little positivity.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a photo of Langston Hughes.
He looks awesome, doesn't he?
He's got the most wonderful smile you've ever seen. Just makes you want to smile. It's very contagious.
Yeah, I think Langston Hughes is one of those guys, like every time you see a picture of him, I think, God, Langston Hughes seems really cool. Like he just looks like a nice, cool guy that you could hang out with.
All right, who's Langston Hughes? I have no idea who this guy is.
So Langston Hughes, I'm going to make a bold claim here. I'm going to go ahead and say that Langston Hughes is the poet laureate of the Harlem Renaissance, right? Like he is the guy from the Harlem Renaissance whose poetry, certainly, we still talk about the most today. When Ian's talking about his book, when he's talking about things like this idea of being in touch with black culture, when he's talking about like this kind of this danger of not being black enough, when talking about like this white voyeurism or appropriation or patronization, like that's the exact sort of things that Langston Hughes is writing about here, right? So thematically, I think Ian and I are just totally in step this week.
Good job, guys.
Yep. Sometimes, witheads, I don't know if you've noticed. Sometimes we're not.
Sometimes, I don't know if you've picked up on this, litheads, but sometimes we don't plan things out at all. So, Joe, where do we start? We have a body of work in front of us. How do we proceed?
Okay. I think it's probably most worthwhile to put yourself in the mindset of a... to put yourself in the mindset of an African American in New York in 19, let's say, 20, right?
I can't do that.
No, Nick, do it. Nick.
Nick, do your best.
Class, listen. Close your eyes.
I can't even try.
There's a lot riding on this.
Hold on. Yes. I'm there. Okay. I'm in, Joe.
Okay. Well, actually, let me ask this. Nick, you were Italian. That's a fact. No, wait. I
was Italian, yes. I'm not anymore, but I was.
Okay.
Guys, this is something I'm really lost.
This is... Okay. Let me back up. Can we cut that last piece out?
Yo, please. Please back up.
No way we're cutting that out.
Nick, you are Greek. One of the things I always notice is when you talk to Americans, like even now when I talk to students, I will frequently ask them, not frequently, I will ask them like what their cultural heritage is, right? Like a...
You frequently ask them that?
It's a check-in question.
Like every morning when they walk in the door or like...
And if they don't answer it correctly, we show them the door. Cultural heritage is something we take a lot of identification in, right? So if you asked me like what my heritage is, I wouldn't answer American, right? Like that's something I would never answer. I would say like, oh, well, I'm like 50% German. I'm 25% Irish. I'm 25% Dutch. And my mom claims that we're like 1/64th Native American, right? Okay. This is something that a lot of white people can do. Right? Can you guys do this? Like, do you have this trick? If I ask you where you're from, what would you answer?
Wisconsin.
America.
Nick, I know for a fact you identify with being Greek. Your name on Settlers of Catan is Olives.
Well, yeah.
If you wanted to, and people in your family have maybe done this, you could probably go back and make like a genealogy study. And you could trace like where your ancestors were from, where their parents were from, where their parents were from, probably going back quite a ways.
Yeah. I think I know where you're going with this, Joe. Let's get to it. Yeah.
If you were Langston Hughes in 1920, you cannot do that. At a certain point, your past becomes just a blank. Like there's just like a null there. Like, you know, it was in Africa, but you don't really know, like, as we all know, Africa is a big place, right? Like what does it mean to be from Africa, right? Like certain tribes, certain countries, etc. So during the Harlem Renaissance, one of the jobs or one of the obsessions, one of the pursuits of these Harlem Renaissance writers and poets and artists was really establishing what it meant to be black in America, right? Like, what does it mean to be black in this country? Like, what is our cultural heritage? And a lot of what they wrote about is just that.
Huh, I got a lot of questions. Okay, does he have like a style to his poetry? Yeah, that's okay. One question. And then does he have like, is there like a standout poem that like was his breakthrough or something like that? How does this work? Is this like coming out with like an album and you have like a single?
Oh, that's such a good question. So I do think he has a few singles that he dropped throughout the years, right? Like, like when you look at Langston Hughes' body of work, there's a ton of it, right? Like this guy wrote a lot of poems over his lifetime. And sprinkled in are a handful of singles. And those singles tend to be what we teach in like American literature. But I like your first question more. Does he have a style?
Okay.
The answer is absolutely. And I think one of the appeals of Langston Hughes, one of the reasons students still like to read him 100 years later at this point, is because he has this super rhythmic style. And Nick, I have a game.
Oh, gosh. Can't believe we didn't start with this.
No. Nope.
I'm excited.
Okay.
If I have to rhyme things or rap, I defer to Ian.
Okay. That's okay, because I'm not going to ask you to do that. Instead, what I have
I am going to ask you to do that, though, Nick. So
okay. Fair enough.
Be ready.
I'm going to read you a poem, and every poem that I read you is going to be 4 lines long. So I guess I'm going to read you a stanza of a poem in most cases. Every poem is going to be 4 lines long. One of the things that's cool about Langston Hughes is he has this really like catchy rhythm to his poetry. And that might seem obvious, but it's not always the case with poetry. Nick, do you know what Burma Shave is?
Nope.
Ian, do you know what Burma Shave is?
Yeah, I do.
Wait, the shaving cream?
It is the shaving cream, the shaving cream company. Ian, do you want to tell us anything that you know about it?
As I'm aware, I never saw one of these in real life, but the Burma Shave thing was they would put signs along the road along the, it was a shaving cream, but that's mm-hmm. not the point. The point is their advertising was to put signs along the road that rhymed, and they were far enough apart that you could like read the whole thing before you got to the next one. And there were little like four line poems, I guess, doggerel that would rhyme, and they would say little funny things. They would say little kind of like comedy, little joke poems, and they would always end.
So you'd see a series of billboards, and well, let me give you a Burma Shave example, right? So it would say something like, the first billboard would say, "You'll love your wife." The second one would say, "You'll love your pa. You'll even love your mother-in-law if you use Burma Shave." A lot of times they were like very shaving themed, right? A lot of like shaving themed poetry, but it had that rhythm. You'll love your wife, you'll love her pa, you'll even love your mother-in-law, right? That was the rhythm to this. So I'm going to read you a poem.
Burma Shave style
and
poem.
You're going to tell me if it was written by Langston Hughes or the good people in the ad offices at Burma Shave.
Oh no.
Incredible.
Are we both doing this, or is this just for Nick?
Oh no, I think we're both doing this. I think this game is for all the lid heads.
Yeah, everybody can play along. Come on, Ian. Mm-hmm.
Call in. Folks, call in. The lines are hot. The phones are ringing.
All right. Are you ready for your first one?
Yeah, we're ready.
All right. In Cupid's little bag of tricks, here's the one that clicks with chicks. In Cupid's little bag of tricks, here's the one that clicks with chicks. Is this Langston Hughes or is this Burma Shave?
All right, I'm gonna just think this one through. Now, it didn't end with a word that could rhyme with Burma Shave, so I'm gonna go Langston Hughes.
That's a good point. I'm gonna say Langston Hughes because for a different reason. Part
is
of
it
his
that
life
you know the poem.
No, part of his life was spent on a chicken farm, I know, and he would always use chicken imagery in his poems, and I think the chicks, that's pretty clearly a reference to his life as a
chicks there, yeah.
Thank you. Ian has a little bit of inside knowledge here. You, of course, know that Langston Hughes writes about raisins and chickens. No, this one is Burma Shave. Of course, the one that clicks with chicks would be like that nice, smooth shave that you get the girls just couldn't resist.
Right. I'm really liking this game, Joe. Keep going.
All right. I've got a bunch, but we don't have to do that many. I've got one here.
All right.
I went down to the river and sat down on the bank. I tried to think but couldn't, so I jumped in and sank. I went down to the river. I sat down on the bank. I tried to think but couldn't, so I jumped in and sank.
Probably to jump in to help shave. So I'm going to go Burma Shave on this one.
Get work up a nice lather. Right?
Get a lather in the water. Yeah.
I think that makes good sense. On the other hand, this is a downer because sinking is not a good thing. Right, and I feel like Burma Shave wouldn't really want to do downers.
They keep it upbeat, huh?
Yeah, I'm going to go Langston Hughes just because of the concern about downers.
Awesome. Ian, really on brand for this podcast. This is a downer, and it is, in fact, a Langston Hughes poem. Yes. However,
that was a dead giveaway.
Yeah, it is a dead giveaway. I will say that that the poem itself, the poem itself is kind of about like life giving you lemons, but you just keep on living. It's about a man who tries to commit suicide a couple of times, but then finally embodies the enduring optimism of its author. He decides things are okay. All right, I've got another one for you. Don't lose your head to save a minute. You need your head. Your brains are in it.
Oh, it's got to be Burma Shave because it's about heads. Which is where you shave from.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
You
shave your face, which is on your head.
But Langston Hughes also had a head. So I'm going to go Langston Hughes.
Langston Hughes did have a head. This one is Burma Shave. Don't lose your head to save. A few years ago, in the city that I live, they do like this sidewalk poetry. Have you seen this?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So like they stamp in poems to various sidewalks, and they really encourage original poems. So I submitted this poem a couple years ago, and it got rejected, and I am furious to this day because I would love to see this poem on a sidewalk in Appleton, Wisconsin. Don't lose your head to save a minute. You need your head. Your brains are in it. All right. I've got one more for you guys. I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. As I live and learn, I dig and be dug in return. Let me say that one more time. I play it cool, I'll dig and jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto, as I live and learn, is dig and be dung in return. Mm. Langston Hughes or Burmashave?
I mean, if this isn't Langston Hughes, I'd be very surprised.
Well, but it's trying to be, sort of
is
like
it trying to be cool.
It's trying to be cool. And I feel like that's the classic advertising thing. No offense. To be like no offense, stretching really, really hard.
I'm read it one more time, Joe.
Let's give one more.
I play it cool. I'll dig and jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto, as I live and learn, is dig and be dug in return.
I think that's Burmashave. I'm going to say Burmashave. It's trying too hard to be cool.
Burmashave.
Oh, guys, this is Langston Hughes.
Oh,
you guys,
him and Ian.
So one of the cool things about this last poem in particular is Langston Hughes was super into jazz music, and jazz music was an integral part of the Harlem Renaissance, right? Just like art and theater and poetry was kind of on the rise, or I guess becoming more...
A lot of mediums.
No, that's exactly it. Like, jazz was part of it. And one of the things that he did is he tried to capture the rhythm of jazz in his poetry. And this is the example that's always pointed to in that regard.
Sweet.
All right.
Burmashave, you done us dirty.
I really like the Burmashave game.
Well, there's...
Can we bring the back Burmashave game every time there's poetry?
we definitely should.
So, I'm not really sure how much to say about Langston Hughes here. Langston Hughes was great. Like, he wrote a lot of really cool poems. He wrote a lot of poems that still get carried forward as, like, the voice of the Harlem Renaissance. And I think the most interesting stuff, like the stuff that I keep coming back to Langston Hughes for, is back to that question I asked you at the beginning of my time here, which is like, imagine that you don't know your cultural identity. Imagine you and, you know, 30 million of people that are your same race don't have a cultural identity. Where do you pull that identity from? Or how do you invent that identity? And that's what Langston Hughes was trying to do in his poetry.
So is his poetry a good like insight into that like that mindset of that time period, or that I don't know if that process is the right word, but that mindset?
One of the things is that mindset was, you know, it's not like it was a homogenous thing. Langston Hughes wrote poems about what he thought it meant to be Black in America, right?
Okay, so he wasn't commentating on that period, or was he?
Go ahead, Ian.
Well, okay. So I was going to add this to what Joe was saying. As far as like what he did, he was really invested, not just in like saying, this is what I see, but also this is how I my sense of it is he was also invested in this is how things should be. So he was not just commentating, but he was also trying to shape at the same time, which is an interesting thing because he has this powerful role, not just as a describer of Harlem culture, of Black cultural identity, but also someone who is actively engaged in making it the way he wants it to be.
Right. Like he understands his role in that culture where he says, look, I am a prominent person in this culture. Like I can kind of, in some ways, invent a Black identity, invent what it means to be a Black American at this point.
Wow.
This, like I said, this wasn't homogenous by any means. And when he wrote his poems, when he talked about what it felt like to be a Black American at this time, he got a lot of criticism from other Black poets, other Black artists, other Black critics who said like, hey, don't air our dirty laundry, right? Like if you want people to take us seriously, you can't talk about being Black. Like you have to talk about like these like higher minded things. You have to talk about like these other pursuits. Like your poetry can't be about Blackness. Like your poetry
can't be about
that.
Was some of the criticism.
That was the criticism, right? From African Americans.
And he responded by writing more poetry.
He responded by saying, fuck you, and watch this.
He wasn't just writing poetry either. He wrote a bunch of stuff. He was a novelist. He was involved in writing plays. Like, he was kind of a man for all seasons.
Sure, yeah, sure.
He has an early essay that he wrote called The Negro Artist and the Radical Mountain. And in that essay, like, one of the very first things that happens is he has this imagined conversation, or maybe a real conversation, with a young black poet. And that black poet specifically says, I want to be a poet, but not a Negro poet. And there's a tremendous amount of tension there, right? Where this guy says, like, look, I want to make art. I don't want to make black art, right? And Langston Hughes, I think, would fall pretty firmly on the other side that said, saying like, hey, if you're black and you're making art, you are talking about what it means to be black. Like that's intrinsic in anything that you write.
You can't escape it. Like, you can't, like, you help to shape the meaning of black cultural identity, if you're doing it.
Right.
I don't know why that bothers me so much. I really don't.
Well, I think when I think of it, it feels unfair.
It feels so, like, unimpressive.
It feels
so oppressive.
Because, like, we think of it, like, from the point of view of white people, and, like, if I wrote a poem, right, like, if I wrote a super famous poem, nobody would look at it and be like, well, this is just German art. This is just Dutch art. This is just Irish art. Like,
more of,
like,
that high German art.
That stuff is totally gone. Oh, like, nobody, that stuff's totally gone. Nobody looks at that and says, like, well, yeah, you're just writing about your cultural experience. It's like, well, no, not really. I'm writing about the human experience. And I think there was this tension at the time in black art when they said, like, well, am I writing about being black, or am I writing about being human? But I think the reality is that so often that those two things are inseparable, right? Those two things are closely linked.
Sorry, just one more point on this.
Yes.
This question of, like, do we kind of, as black people, do we kind of own and, consciously, like, push forward a sense of black identity, or do we try to do whatever it takes to sort of fit in and survive and not really be outspoken about our blackness? This is, like, one of the controversies, the question of respectability, really. It's one of the controversies which has sort of, like, focused black thought for the last 150 years. This controversy goes back a long, long way, and we see it's kind of we see it in the conflict between Martin Luther King Jr. and the sort of peaceful protest, as opposed to Malcolm X and the desire for you know, violence when necessary, but also Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, they kind of had this same question of, like, what do we do with ourselves? Are we just going to say, screw it? Like, let's own our cultural identity, or are we going to try and be sophisticated, highbrow, fit in, and maybe lose some of our individuality that way?
So while I deliberate on who won, you guys want to hawk this show?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, folks. Litheads, I'm talking to you. Thank you today for being part of this You Don't Know Lit journey. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Thank you for posting about us on your social media and sharing our posts and so forth. Thank you especially for telling your friends and recommending books for us to read. We really appreciate this. So if you want to keep this sort of, like, respect and thankfulness train rolling, you can head on over to our social media, which is at You Don't Know Lit on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. You can get updates on the show, new episodes dropping every week or every strong, depending on who you are. And sometimes we post cool book covers and other interesting facts about the stuff that we do over there. You can also suggest a book for us to read. You can do this via our website, youdontknowlitpodcast.com, or you can do this by mentioning us on social media. Tell us what to read. We always appreciate those because they're often new to us. Mm-hmm. Joe, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, the only thing I would add, Litheads, is if you've enjoyed this episode, if you enjoy our episodes, if you can't wait for Monday, like I know I can't, to see Nick drop the show each week, go ahead and leave us a review on whatever your podcast player of choice is. Apple iTunes, Spotify. I personally use Pocket Cast. But leave us a review. 5 stars would be fantastic, but follow your heart, Litheads, right? Follow your hearts.
This is tough because I really want to read Ian's book, but Joe didn't read any poetry. I got like nothing
from
what he was actually offering. So I really just want to hear anything from Burma Shave.
So little poetry from Joe.
Yeah. Ian, you win.
I got a great poem about rivers, great. Guys.
I have, to wrap us up here, the epigraph.
A Burma Shave ad?
No, I wish. I should have. You know what? We need to incorporate just more Burma Shave content in general on this show. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great idea, Ian.
Slogans. Maybe someday, maybe some cop-out episode, I do all my synopsis in the form of Burma Shave poetry. I don't know. We'll see.
Guys, if you want to know what happened to Burma Shave, sales declined in the 1950s, and it was bought by Philip Morris in 1963. So if we're looking for a Burma Shave sponsor, we're going to have to... Are those the cigarette people? Are we going to have to sell Marlboro? Yeah, so
they took all the brilliant advertising. They're like, well, who has the best advertising? Burma Shave. Great. Let's kill more people and hire them as our advertising team.
Bring them in.
Bring them in.
So my victory quote is not a Burma Shave poem. I'm sorry to all of the loyal litheads who wanted that. This poem is part of this poem is the epigraph to Larson's book. And it actually works with Joe's questions earlier about what does it mean to be from Africa? Like, how do we make sense of that? What's the connection between being African and being American? Is there an African American identity? This is an excerpt from a poem called Heritage, which is by County Cullen.
You're not reading something from your book?
He's reading a poem, Nick.
It's a poem from the beginning of this book. So yes, my book. Okay. This is by County Cullen, who is a contemporary of Langston Hughes. I'm not going to read the whole poem because it's super long. I'm just going to read the good part. The poem is called Heritage. Africa. A book one thumbs listlessly till slumber comes. Unremembered are her bats circling through the night, her cats crouching in the river reeds, stalking gentle flesh that feeds by the river brink. No more does the bugle-throated roar cry that monarch claws have leapt from the scabbards where they slept. Silver snakes that once a year doff the lovely coats you wear, seek no covert in your fear lest a mortal eye should see. What's your nakedness to me? Here no leprous flowers rear fierce corollas in the air. Here no bodies sleek and wet, dripping mingled rain and sweat, tread the savage measures of jungle boys and girls in love. What is last year's snow to me? Last year's anything? The tree budding yearly must forget how its past arose or set, bough and blossom, flower, fruit, even what shy bird with mute wonder at her travail there meekly labored in its hair. One 3 centuries removed from the scenes his fathers loved, spicy grove, cinnamon tree, what is Africa to me?